Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Greetings and welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Tapson. If you're not familiar with the 1996 book, The Clash of Civilizations and the Remaking of World Order by Samuel Huntington, then I urge you to read it. It's not as dated as you might think it would be for a nearly 30-year-old book about geopolitics. For example, one of his observations, which I doubt he could get away with saying today without the cancel culture mob coming for him, is that Islam has bloody borders. By that he means, and I'll just quote him here, quote, "Wherever one looks along the perimeter of Islam, Muslims have problems living peacefully with their neighbors. The question naturally arises as to whether this pattern of late 20th century conflict between Muslim and non-Muslim groups is equally true of relations between groups from other civilizations. In fact, it is not. Muslims make up about one-fifth of the world's population, but in the 1990s they've been far more involved in intergroup violence than the people of any other civilization. The evidence is overwhelming." Unquote. Okay, that was from Samuel Huntington's book, The Clash of Civilizations. And yes, he was writing about the 1990s, but his observation about the antagonism between Islam and other cultures clearly still holds true today. Only the Islam problem has extended beyond borders now, thanks to the mass migration into European countries from the Middle East and Africa, migration that has radically altered the demographics and cultural landscape of the West, by which I mean not just Europe, but Australia, and to a lesser extent in the United States. What is the Islam problem? It is the demonstrable reality that Islam is incompatible with Western civilization. No matter how much the anti-Western multiculturalist elites want to bully you into believing otherwise. Does this mean that all Muslims are incapable of assimilating successfully into Western countries? Of course not. But the extent to which they assimilate successfully depends entirely on the extent to which they embrace being Westernized, as opposed to viewing the host culture through a supremacist lens as one to be subverted from within and replaced ultimately with an Islamic caliphate under Sharia law. In fact, I'm just going to go ahead and say it. When it comes to the conflict between Western and Islamic values, we are not talking about a clash of civilizations, but the clash of civilization and barbarism. Change my mind. I raise this point because my guest today, at the Right Take, is a very interesting gentleman who was raised Muslim in the Middle East and not only converted to Christianity, but who has made it his mission to defend Judeo-Christian values, combat totalitarian ideologies, and educate the West out of the moral confusion paralyzing us about the threat of fundamentalist Islam. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss this conversation. And don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take, if you don't already, so that you don't miss any of the compelling conversations we're having here. Don't touch that dial. My guest today at the intersection of politics and culture is a guy who works at the intersection of political theology and geopolitical analysis. A former Muslim turned Christian, he holds the Master of Theological Studies and is the co-founder and CEO of Project X, that's spelled E-X, which we'll talk about in a moment. Dan Bermawi, welcome to the Right Take Podcast.
Thank you so much, Mark. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for coming on. There are so many Islam-related topics in the news these days, or Palestinian-related, that I hardly know where to begin asking you for your take on these things, but let's just start with who you are and what you do and why. Tell us about Project X, for example. What goes on there? What's its mission, and why did you launch it?
Sure. Project X is a vision that started immediately after October 7th. After witnessing the outrage on the Western streets, I realized that the same ideology that have left my region in ruins made its way to the West. And even though I come from a Muslim background, I have been involved in the Christian world, the Christian ministry, for a very long time. And I was not planning on pursuing this as a full-time job. And by this, I mean challenging the Islamic narratives that have shaped the politics, the society in my region, and now is infiltrating the West and threatening the West. So Project X came as a response to what happened after October 7. And we basically do two things. We educate the West and we challenge the East, if I put it simply. Yeah, so it's a nonprofit organization now in the United States, and we provide, as I said, education. Try to meet with lawmakers, try to influence policies to make sure that the pillars of the Western civilization is not impacted by the Islamic values that are antithetical to the Western values.
And by October 7th, obviously, you're referring to the October 7, 2023 attacks in Israel waged by Hamas, which massacred more than 1,200 Israelis. And of course, there were the kidnappings. And then there were the pro-Palestinian protests all around the Western world, and pro-Hamas even protests. That's the outrage that you're referring to, obviously.
Yeah. Sure.
Tell us your personal story about growing up Muslim and why you begin to reject Islam and explore Christianity instead.
I grew up in Jordan to a Muslim family. And in 2006, the Danish cartoonist controversy, if you remember, a Danish cartoonist drew the Prophet of Islam that sent waves of rage across the Islamic world. I was emotionally affected, and I made a decision to defend Islam and to dedicate myself to serving Allah and Islam. So I became very committed, not for a long time, almost a year. And in that year, I got to experience something that changed the trajectory of my life. And that thing was spiritual. I realized that nothing I could do that would change my position with Allah. We call it in Christianity justification. I felt unjustified, even though I used to pray five times a day, very devout, but the enmity between me and Allah remained. So that's why I decided to stop going to the mosque, stop being committed, but I didn't leave Islam at that point. But long story short, I got introduced to the New Testament, reading through the pages of the Gospels. I was converted, and in Jordan, because almost 99% of the population are Muslims, I couldn't practice my faith there, so I had to leave the country. I moved to Lebanon, where I lived for the next 15 years of my life. I studied there, between there, South Africa and the United States. And I led a global Christian organization as their regional director in the Middle East. I have managed projects across eight different countries in the Middle East, evangelistic in nature. But I was also concerned about policy because I saw how Islam informs policies and reshape the society. In 2023, 2 months before October 7, I moved to the U.S. to pursue my studies, and I was planning to continue in the same path, working in the nonprofit sector. But as I say, October 7 happened, and other personal stories and confrontation, I realized that the threat is real, that last bastion of freedom is at risk, and I had to act. I had to do something.
Interesting. Now, you say that you began reading, as a Muslim, you began reading the New Testament. Was there somebody, and you don't have to name names, but was there someone who introduced you to that, or what made you turn to the New Testament in the first place?
Yeah, it was a friend And there were rumors about him leaving Islam. But when I met him and I asked him about that, he denied for security reasons. But through our conversations, he was planting the seeds of doubt in my heart. And he was the one who introduced me or who directed me to read the New Testament. Of course, I found out later that years before, he has been through a lot of troubles for converting to Christianity. And in Jordan, according to the law, you lose your civil rights if you leave Islam. You're not you don't have the right to vote. They divorce you from your wife. They take your children. It was a mess for him. So he had to convert back to Islam in order to keep his civil rights. But he never converted in heart. He remained a Christian. And years later, after almost 10 years of leaving Jordan, I got reconnected to him and we worked together in ministry. So it was something.
And after leaving Islam, were you targeted or threatened in any way for your apostasy?
So because I was young at the time, nobody paid attention to me. People thought I was going through some major crisis. But thankfully, my father was very understanding, and he would wrestle with me, you know, argue, talk, and he was like a friend. And he was the one who taught me to read, because he's a heavy reader. And I remember when I was even 12 years old, my father bought a copy of the Bible into the house, even though it's not permissible in Islam. But my father did it anyway. But of course, at the time, I was too young to understand anything. You remember reading in that copy, but a few days later, my uncle came and he found that we have the Bible and he burned it. So, but anyway, no, I was not persecuted it's like by my family. There was a few things happened. The secret police in Jordan heard about me. They called me and we met and they threatened me. But of course, it was a threat toward or directed at an 18, 19 years old kid. So it was not a big deal. But the group of devout Muslims that I used to be part of in the mosque, they were the real threat. They visited me several times, tried to convince me. Of course, I was stubborn. I didn't care about secrecy. I was open about my conversion. So after a while, because they noticed that I talked to a lot of people, a lot of friends, I explained to them what I found in the Bible and how Islam is not could not be a religion from God. There is no divine revelation. So they made a few threats, and that's why I ended up leaving Jordan.
Wow. Well, that's very courageous of you. You have written
or courageous
or stubborn,
stupid.
They're stupid. You have written about how Islamic doctrine can lead to a system of control rather than spiritual fulfillment. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Oh yeah. So basically, everyone looks at the Arab world and the Islamic world, and they see dictatorships, and they think, you know, these dictators, they are the reason why progress is stifled in the Islamic world. But in fact, the dictators are the product of the theology of the region. And let me explain, and this will give you a better understanding of how control is the nature of the system there. So the God you worship, the way you see God, determines how your life is going to be. Now, people might argue that, like, we are beyond the religion time. We are secular now. We don't care for that. People are not, religion is not central. But that's not true at all. Because every one of us has a God, whether you claim to worship a God or not, you have a God. And that God is the entity that has the priority in your life. It is the thing that shapes how you think, and it manifests itself in your tangible life. So God in Islam, his image is an image of a dictator, an image of a very, it's a bully God, because you open the Quran randomly, just pick a page and read it through the words of the Quran. It's all about punishment and threats and torture. And at the same time, promises of beautiful paradise where you will enjoy all your desires. Now, that image produces a mentality of fear and greed. You're afraid, or you are trying to get the reward. There is no relationship between a Muslim and Allah beyond these lines. I'm trying to avoid his punishment, and at the same time, I'm trying to gain his reward. So as a result, just think of what traumatized, afraid, terrified people end up doing. They end up projecting their fear in a form of anger. And that's how a group of afraid people shaped by this theology end up replicating the symbol of authority in politics. They end up electing people who are, I would say, who have the same characteristics of God. They have to be dictators. Now, maybe people will argue against this. They will push and they say, no, it doesn't make sense. It makes sense, because if you elect someone who is not a dictator, that would create cognitive dissonance. Like, you believe something about authority inside your heart, but the reality is different. So you cannot reconcile reality with belief, and you end up confused. And I'm talking here about collectively, not only on the individual level, but the collective level. What is authority? Authority is tyrannical. Authority is powerful, is rigid, is very solid, very confident. And that's why we end up with patriarchy and we end up with dictatorships. So it is a direct result of theology.
And speaking of ideology, let's talk about ideological violence. Samuel Huntington, who was the author of The Clash of Civilizations, wrote that Islam has bloody borders, suggesting that Islamic societies and culture are always at odds, often violently so, with non-Islamic cultures. Do you think violence is inherent in Islamic fundamentalism?
Listen, Mark, every culture was violent at some point. That's how we survive. Now, if you look at the time when Islam emerged, you have the Byzantine Empire, very violent. You have that Jewish scripture, a lot of violence. You have the Persian Empire, very violent. Everybody's violent. So don't blame Muhammad for creating a violent religion, a violent political ideology. Arabs have been trying to, or some figures in the Arab history, they tried to imitate the empires they were surrounded by. But they failed because of the tribal nature of the region. But Muhammad succeeded. The problem in Islam is not the existence of violence. It is that sanctity of violence. So that's the problem. If you look at the history of Europe, violence was there, but they grew out of it because it was not sacred. It was not something divinely revealed and commanded. Now, what happened in Islam is that in the 7th century Arabia, you needed violence. It was the only way to survive. But when you make it a religion, people cannot break out of it. It becomes permanent. And that's why we are still struggling as civilization with Islamic violence until today. In order to get rid of the violence in Islam, you need to desanctify the text. So the West needs to help Muslims to desanctify the violent text that they hold dear as divinely revealed and inspired. They have to challenge the text itself. If the West keeps saying Islam is a religion of peace, the problem is Islamism, just a group of people who hijacked Islam, and it's a fringe interpretation, they are not helping because they are protecting the text that keeps on giving birth to violence. They are protecting it from scrutiny. So that's the problem with violence in Islam. So whenever I write about how Muhammad was violent, for example, today I wrote something on X about how Muhammad said to his soldiers, invade Tabuk, which was under the Byzantine rule, and you will get their daughters. So he was incentivizing Muslim soldiers with women, with war booty, right? Now, when I write about that, I'm not criticizing Muhammad because he was violent. I'm criticizing Muhammad as the ultimate role model for Muslims who are bringing that 7th century war reality into the 21st century. They are importing it. So that's how we should approach violence in Islam.
And is that part of the strategy and aim of your Project X, is to counter that ideological violence by helping to desanctify the Quran?
Absolutely. That's what we are trying to do. We are trying to help Muslims, just like I was helped, to see the reality beyond the text, and at the same time, educate the West about how to help Muslims. You're not helping them. You are, as Tom Holland said, you're suing the branch that you're sitting on. You are cutting the branch, and that is your civilization, and you're burning your own house. You cannot keep doing this. The only way to help Muslims is by confronting their ideology. You cannot be tolerant and non-confrontational and expect Muslims to look at their text critically and do some self-critical thinking, because Islam has shielded them from that. The architecture of the Islamic mentality is all about shielding Muslims from criticizing Islam. That's why they respond to criticism with violence, because that's the only way to please Allah, to gain his favor. I remember when I was in school, there was a bully. I was trying to please in order to avoid his wrath, I would say. So how do I do that? I side with him against anybody that he sees as an enemy. So I was trying to please him by attacking his enemies. The same way Muslims, they go and behead Charlie Hebdo journalist because they drew Muhammad. Because they're saying to God, God, you see, we are defending you. Would you love us? Would you accept us? You know what I'm talking about. So it's really goes down to that point. You need to help Muslims think strategically about their future through criticizing and desanctifying their text.
You've noted that Muslims in the West often become more zealous in their faith than those in Muslim-majority countries. What do you think accounts for that? And what are the consequences for Western societies?
Well, it's the same point, actually. When they are living in Islamic countries, Muslims have one way to salvation, and that way is obeying all the commandments of Allah. because there is no jihad. When you live in an Islamic country, there is no jihad. And jihad is the only way in Islam where you guarantee heaven without any giving account about your works. If you're a Muslim, you die in jihad, you're a martyr, you go to heaven. That's by the text of the Quran. But if you're living in an Islamic country, that window is closed. You're competing with your fellow Muslims about who obey the commandments of Allah more, praying more, fasting more, and with the process of time, you give up, you fluctuate, you pray, you don't pray. That's the only way. But when you move to the West, it's the land of the infidels. It is the enemies of Allah. Now, you have the chance to side with Allah against his enemies, to assert your allegiance to Islam. And that's why you become more open to radicalization. And the implication of that, the consequences of that is ground is fertile for more radicalization, because Islamic movements, radical Muslims would come and they will establish Islamic centers, Quran centers, community, charities, etc., etc., and they will get more chance to radicalize more people.
Some people like to talk about building bridges between Islam and other faiths in order to overcome tensions and conflicts. Do you think that interfaith dialogue between Jews and Christians on the one hand and Muslims on the other hand is helpful and effective, or is that just another strategy, or do Muslims see it as just another strategy for Islamic conquest?
Listen, Mark, I'm an insider. I know what Muslims say behind the closed doors, and I know what Christians say behind the closed doors, because I was a Muslim and I'm Christian. And behind the closed doors, Christians, they want to invade all the Islamic countries with the gospel. And why do they want to do that? Because they believe they are carrying a gift to Muslims. And that's why they come up with all kinds of tactics to invade the Islamic countries. They send students to learn Arabic. They work in nonprofit. It doesn't matter. They have their strategies, right? But at the end of the day, what they say behind the closed doors is like, we want these people to know God. We are bringing the knowledge of God to them. Now, behind the closed doors, Muslims believe that the rule of Allah must be established over all the earth. It is the promise of Muhammad. It is the promise of Allah. It's going to happen. It's going to happen. And it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Now, interfaith dialogue. When you want to have a dialogue with someone, you must, at the beginning, make sure that your epistemological resources align. It's like, for example, let's talk about the sanctity of life. And we want to have a dialogue about abortion. I know that your starting point for being pro-life is the sanctity of life. And you know my starting point as someone who believes in abortion is the freedom and the value of women, their rights. So both of us are starting from good points, but we want to reconcile how we look at these things. My epistemology is not saying that life is not good, and therefore I stand with abortion. No, I know life is good, but I'm arguing here the rights of women. But when it comes to interfaith dialogue, the epistemology is different. For Muslims, it's the Quran. It's the revealed truth of Allah. There is no place, no room for consciousness. It's not about what you think. It's not about your rationality, reason. No, it's about the revealed text. You cannot construct what is right and what is wrong. It is revealed. However, in Christianity, even though we have a sacred text, and we also believe that truth is not constructed, it is revealed. However, we also believe that in natural law, we believe in consciousness. We believe that we are rational beings capable of thinking and reasoning and wrestling with God. Wrestling with God is biblical. It's what Jacob did, wrestling with God in order to form our identities. Jacob became Israel after he wrestled with God. And this is one of the pillars of the Western civilization. It's our freedom to think. So how do you bring these two faith, these two epistemologies together to dialogue? What kind of dialogue are you going to have? So for Muslims, it is a strategy to, I would say, renovate the reputation of Islam. And for Christians and Jews, it's a hopeless attempt to reconcile with a made-up, manufactured version of Islam that was designed for Western consumption only.
What are you most concerned about with what I would say is the current expansion of Islam or Islamism globally? Are there specific regions or trends that alarm you the most?
Well, I see a lot of people in the West are concerned about women wearing niqab or going to the beaches wearing something called burkini, not bikini. They're worried about halal food and segregation in schools. I don't care about that. I don't care about Sharia. Implementing Sharia in the West is just a way to destroy our argument about the threat of Islam. Even Islamic countries are not applying Sharia law. It's not about the Sharia. It's about the individual liberties and rights. It's ideological threat. It's not about certain. It's not about police. What do they call it? Morality police. It's like morality police has been abolished in Saudi Arabia, even. So you won't see it in Manhattan. Trust me. That's not the threat. The threat is when Islam has the power to legislate, to change laws that directly connected to your freedom of speech, for example. They are pushing for blasphemy laws. They made up the term Islamophobia to stop you from scrutinizing the text. So these are sacred values in the West. These are the conditions of free societies. When Islam start messing up with them, that's the threat. That's the problem. That reduced the ability of the society to be free and therefore less creativity, because the creativity is the product of freedom. And with less creativity, you have less innovation. Less innovation, stifled economy, and the crisis happened. So you need to think about it in matter of legislation, policy, lawmaking, how Islam, the Islamic values, which is antithetical to the Western values, are going to reshape the West. Look at what happened in the Arab world after the French and the British mandate. The French and the British brought modernity to the Arab world. There was no hijab. There was no segregation in schools, which leads, by the way, to sexual repression and leads to sexual supercharging. It's crazy. It's a crazy combination of elements that destroy societies. But we can't talk about this. It's a different point. But what I want to say is the British and the French brought modernity to the Arab world. And we were on a trajectory to progress. However, the Muslim Brotherhood, with different political dynamics, and they were used by King Faisal of Saudi Arabia to establish the so-called Islamic Awakening in 1962, which led to the reshaping of the Arab world. And they completely abolished all the modernity that was achieved under the British and the French mandate, the secularism that was brought to the region. Now, that narrative could be repeated easily in the West. How? What happened in the Arab world? They controlled policies, lawmaking, schools, curriculum, education. So I don't care about niqab. I don't care about halal food. I don't care about any of that, or sharia courts even. Let them have their own sharia courts and manage their own civil affairs. Who cares about that? People have the freedom to worship whoever they want. It's a private faith. I don't care about it. I care about when Islam reshapes the laws in the country. That's going to change everything. It's going to change the structure of society.
And are there any practical solutions for policymakers that you could recommend that would help prevent that? And for that matter, solutions that ordinary individuals can make use of it to address the challenges of Islam?
Well, whenever I talk about the solution, people think it's overreaching. It's impossible. But the solution is really to recognize Islam as a political ideology. Islam is not only a religion. It is a holistic system. It has everything. It has foreign policy. It's called jihad. It has finance policies called zakat and Islamic financial system. It has governance. It's called the caliphate. It's the ummah, the nation of Islam. So we're talking about a political ideology. So you cannot control the influence of Islam on your policies as long as you treat Islam as a religion. Because if Islam is only a religion, then by the laws of the land, they have the freedom to do whatever they want, to preach whatever they want, to teach whatever they want. You cannot scrutinize them. You cannot monitor their funding resources. Of course, they made up the Islamism thing to try to control, to have the government. I'm talking about the government, the British government, the United States government. They came up with Islamism in order to have some liberty in controlling Islamic jihad in the West. But it's not working because who is an Islamist? An Islamist is a terrorist. So you can only just monitor the terrorists. You cannot monitor a school teacher who is indoctrinating the next generation of Americans about the value of women. The same system I talked about at the beginning, what the authority looks like. If the authority looks like the virgin in Islam, then the people in any country are the enemies of the state. The state is not there to serve me. The state is there to exploit me and to oppress me. So how can you have a functioning society when the people think that they are the enemies of the government? In America, regardless of all the corruption in Washington, D.C., people still believe in government. They still vote. They still believe that they can hold the government accountable. So the government is not their enemy. Of course, that you have the communist and different movements, political movements, they are aligned with Islam because they both have this vision this worldview that, you know, the government is the oppressor, we are the oppressed. So in order to avoid the future or the destiny of Europe, unfortunately, Europe is, I'm not sure, some countries in Europe are beyond salvation. Because Islam has made its way into the major institutions, and there's no way to take them out of these institutions. Absolutely not. You can't. We will see within decades the same scenario that played in the Arab world manifested in Europe. Now, in America, how to prevent that? You need to be real to the threat. You cannot claim that you want to protect the Western civilization and at the same time you don't have a diagnosis of the threat. What is the threat? Is it a group of extremists or is it the ideology that the fountain that all of them keeps drinking from? If Islam has the seeds that produce extremists, and we know from history that the Muslim Brotherhood, they, whenever they are within the system, they claim they don't have any relationship with terrorism, they only focus on policy. That is terrorism inside the government, when they plan to change laws in order to accommodate more Islamic values into the society.
I wanted to ask you this next question, even though it might open up a whole other huge subtopic, but I wanted to get your take on it. Tell us about your conversion, not just from Islam to Christianity, but your conversion from supporting the Palestinian cause to exposing the truth behind it.
I wouldn't call myself as a Palestine supporter at any point. I'm Jordanian. In Jordan, we don't like Palestinians, and Palestinians don't like Jordanians. However, I was obliged by Islam to stand with Palestine. So I was not really standing with Palestine because I cared about it, but because it was an Islamic cause. Now, many people are trying to present the Arab-Israeli conflict as a territorial dispute. It's not. It's a religious hatred masked as territorial dispute, resistance to occupation, all of that. So anyway, I used to go to march out with Palestinians and Jordanians and other people on the streets of Amman against Israel. I had no understanding of the history of the conflict. Everything I believed was the Jews are the enemies of Allah, and they have occupied an Islamic land, and I must resist them. However, after my conversion and when I started reading history, I was surprised at the first time I read the Old Testament and found that, you know, the Bible is talking about Israel. In the land. And then in my mind, I spent my life reading the Quran. Immediately, I connected the people of Israel to the people of Israel in the Quran. They're the same people. It's their land. They're not a different group of people. But of course, more than that, it was the history of the conflict itself, understanding how after the fall of the Ottoman Empire, it was the first time in history since the days of Muhammad, the Islamic world had no caliphate, no empire. And how that happened at the same time that a Jewish state was being established in the region and the nation state concept was being introduced to the region. And so I connected the dots, and I'm talking about this in my book, and I explain how all of this happened, the manufacturing of the Palestinian cause, the hijacking of Palestine, hijacking of Jerusalem, all of that. I became a supporter of Israel because I believe that Israel is fighting this war, the civilizational war, on behalf of the free world. I believe that Israel is fighting on behalf of the U.S. and on behalf of Europe, even though Europe is letting that enemy, the ideological enemy, into their home. But Israel is still fighting, and it's the only state that has been fighting Islamic Jihad for the past 77 years. While being stabbed by the same people that Israel is fighting the war for. So I'm trying to explain to the West that standing with Israel has nothing to do with standing with the government of Israel. It's standing with your representative in this civilizational war.
I see on your Substack page that you have a book coming out in October called Rebranding Jihad. What can you tell us about that?
Well, that's not going to be the final name of the book. I'm considering different names, but the book basically...
I like it, though.
Yeah, maybe I'll stick to it. We'll see. So the book is coming out on October 7th. Pre-order is going to start on September 7th. I believe this book is very important, not because I'm the author, but because it helps people see without exaggeration, without fear-mongering, without trying to draw a very dark image about Islam. No, just basic analysis to show that Islam is a political ideology. It's not a religion. It's not only a religion. I show that through historical analysis. It's not another book about Islam where you have a lot of information about the history of Islam. I don't care about that. There are thousands of books out there where you can read about Islam. No, I provide certain specific analysis to show how Islam emerged as a political entity. not only a religion, then how that political ideology is the root behind the Arab-Israeli conflict. And then I talk about why Islam is incompatible with the Western civilization. Because people keep saying again, they keep saying niqab, sharia law. It's not that. Islam is incompatible because of something else. And I try to explain it in the third chapter. Then I talk about Islam in the West, what's happening today, why is it a threat? So the third chapter is why it's incompatible, and the fourth chapter is why is it a threat? Then I talk about the Abrahamic religions, and I explain how Judaism and Christianity working together is the only way to fight this civilizational war, not only against Islam, but against all the ideologies that are trying to take the West down. And last chapter, I talk about the current geopolitics of the Middle East, reformation in Islam, how to read the current situation, and how to understand what's going to happen later.
I'm very much looking forward to reading that. Dan, where should people go online to keep up with your commentary and what you're working on?
So people can find me on X, Twitter, formerly, under the name Dan, D-A-N-B-U-R-M-A-W-Y, Dan Bormawi. And they can go to my website, which is connected to my Substack. That is project-xex.org. I encourage them to subscribe to my Substack. It's they will help me keep doing this work, and they will be updated, and they will receive my articles on a weekly basis.
Excellent. Good to know. Dan Bormawi, thanks for joining us at The Right Take, and keep up the important work at Project X.
Thank you so much, Mark. I appreciate that you invited me to be in your show, and looking forward to see you again.
Likewise. And thank you, listeners, for joining us. Keep an eye out for Dan's book, Rebranding Jihad, or whatever the title might be, later this year. Don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take if you haven't already, and if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Be seeing you. The Right Take with Mark Tapson is a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center and Front Page Magazine. Unauthorized reproduction of this podcast without express written consent is prohibited.